That Great Business Show. Winner, highly commended award, Irish Podcast Awards.
Welcome to episode 175 of That Great Business Show, home of great business tips, insights, and opportunities on every episode, delivered in our commute-friendly package. And it's all thanks to De Facto Shaving Oil, the world's best shaving oil. Not a beard oil, it's a shaving oil. And just a couple of drops onto a wet face and you are sorted. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide, it is your ideal travel companion. DeFactoShave.com.
De Facto, the revolutionary shaving oil, changing the face of shaving. For the smoothest shave of your life, just add water. No more lathering up or cleaning up afterward. Just add a few drops of water and you're ready to go. De Facto's blend of all natural oils hydrates and protects your skin. No more razor burns or irritation. A spa treatment for your face. Perfect for all skin types and lasts so much longer than traditional foams or gels. De Facto, a shaving revolution. Just add water. Available from selected pharmacies and from defactoshave.com.
I'm Conal Mora in Foytestiach. Coming up, a man who always wanted to be an entrepreneur, so started selling ponchos, a business that didn't last a wet day. But he's now running his own international business and a three-generation Dublin business that has seen it all, their products going in and out of fashion, a disastrous fire that destroyed all 80 of their machines, and the emigration of the third-generation family member. And despite all of that, they have survived. And that's the spirit of enterprise we love on That Great Business Show. And here is a first for The Great Business Show. My first guest is a glove cutter by trade. And I know he's the first glove cutter I have ever had a chat with, because I think there may be only two glove cutters in the entire island of Ireland. Gerard Horn is the third generation of the Horn family that has been making gloves in Dublin. A business that has seen all the ups and downs that an enterprise can go through. Back in the 1960s, they were employing over 100 people making gloves for Christian Dior, Harrods, Bloomingdale's and Saks. They also had a contract to supply 10,000 First Communion gloves. Then disaster struck and their factory, along with 80 machines, burnt down. Down, but not out, they eventually bought two machines from a UK glove maker that was closing down. And they are still in business making gorgeous gloves. Ger Horn, glove cutter, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thanks. I don't know how to respond to that.
Well, I'll tell you what you can do, because you can start by telling me you have a PhD in the most unusual subject of Irish emigration to New Zealand. Just give 30 seconds as to how did you end up writing a thesis, I presume it's a thesis, on Irish emigrants to New Zealand.
Yeah, well, I did a primary degree in history in Maynooth many years ago in the 1990s. And about 20 years ago in the early 2000s, I was living out in New Zealand. Myself and my wife had moved out there. We had moved out to spend some time with some pals of ours and settled down there. Really liked the place, doing office work and various bits and pieces. And I thought it might be time to go back to college. So I did a PhD in history, which is what I'd wanted to do, and I really enjoyed it. And Irish emigration seemed like an obvious thing to do, because I was able to bring my own experience in terms of, you know, having studied a little bit of Irish history, and
of course that made you the entrepreneur that you are.
It is indeed. I tell you what it does, because sometimes particularly humanities and arts PhDs get a bit of a rough ride. But what it does do is teach you hard work. I mean, you know, there's nobody coming out of a PhD program without having worked bloody hard. And there's nobody who's working for themselves who doesn't work bloody hard. So it's...
But you don't call yourself Dr. Jer?
No, I don't.
I'm going to call you Dr. Jer.
You can if you like. I did at one stage, the bank were annoying me. So I put down my doctor on that and insist on.
And then you came home because you couldn't bear to stay out in lovely New Zealand.
Yeah, well, I tell you... Look, we had two kids out there and we loved it. My parents were getting older. My wife's parents weren't getting any younger either. So we thought it was probably a good time to bring the family back home if we were going to come, because otherwise the kids would have been starting school and I mean, I think that would have seen us down there. And we were there for nearly 10 years. So.
To the beginning of the Horn dynasty, yeah. It was your great-granddad who came over from the UK and set it up initially.
Yeah, so my granddad was a glove cutter in the UK. He had worked for Dents, which is a big traditional glove-making firm there, and he'd worked his way up through that. In the middle of the 1930s, himself and another guy were recruited from there to come across and work in an Irish glove factory, which they did. And George worked there for 7 or 8 years before he went out on his own and set up in the back garden. So he set up there in the mid-1943. And soon after that, he had established a factory up in Ashtown beside the Ashtown Tin Box Company on the roundabout there. And they were there right through the 50s, 60s and up until 1972 when the factory burnt down.
And I don't know whether you weren't around for that, were you?
No.
But it must have been. He must have told you about it. I mean, I said this to you off air, I cannot imagine anything worse for somebody in business than that.
No, it was devastating. I mean, it completely destroyed the business. They had a second factory in Donegal, which they had to close. They started again, but at a much smaller level. And I suppose like all of these things, once you lose out on a kind of a cycle of being able to service your customers, then they've moved somewhere else by the time you get back up and running. And unfortunately for them, it's not like you can kind of walk across the road and buy yourself another 80 machines, because a lot of the machines that we use would be quite specialized, so they would have been made for purpose. So it was, I think it took them two full years to get back up and running again. I remember talking to John Quirk, who used to work with my dad for a long time, and he was saying he can remember 6 or 8 months that he spent cleaning machines, you know, trying to recover the different
traumatic,
parts of it.
Yeah, I would say, yeah.
It's fairly awful.
And then how in the name of did your granddad was get Christian Dior, Harrods? I mean, these are big names, Bloomingdale, Saks. Yeah.
But they, I mean, it was a, you know, it was a big operation, and they would have gone with, there was a group called the Irish Menswear Fashion Guild, so themselves and 6 or 7 other businesses supported by the CTT at the time.
Which is, for those old enough, will know it as Coras Trocht Dála.
That's correct. And they would have gone to the States for 3 or 4 months every year. They would have turned around, they would have gone to...
On a roadshow, was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, they would have...
3 to 4 months?
Yeah, he would have spent 12 weeks a year at least, 12 to 16 weeks.
And I am going back now. Are we travelling by ship now or in the air?
That is a good point. I suspect in the air. I know in the air by the end of it, because I have a photograph of them all getting off at it.
At the end of it. But initially, I think that could have been a 6-day trip across the Atlantic.
It could have been. And they would have built that up through the 50s and 60s with all the traditional things that, you know, listen to your show sometimes, you know, the 50s and 60s version of the sports that people get nowadays from the state and that kind of stuff. So they would have worked at the various different state agencies to promote things there. The entire group had an agent across in the States who was very good at pushing them. And I mean, I think from our point of view, the size of America is so big, and the fact that there were these department stores where you could, you know, if you sold 2 or 3 different styles in 2 or 3 different sizes, you know, in 2 or 3 different colors to a department store that has 100 outlets, then suddenly you're into kind of big numbers. And that was pretty good for a long time. Unfortunately, then the factory burnt down.
And back to basics, yeah.
Yeah, back to basics. I mean, they recovered very well. They started again. They moved down to Prussia Street and they got some contracts. First of all, the Michelin Tire Company, so they made a huge number of industrial gloves for Michelin.
And to tell the story behind, what kind of gloves? These were not, these were no ordinary gloves, these were. What kind of gloves were they? They were extra fluffy or something.
They were made of a particular type of, they're made of a particular type of lambskin, and, you know, it was important, the kind of the grease content that was in them. So they had to be very flexible. They had to be able to feel what they were doing. And the gloves couldn't kind of omit, I don't know what the right word would be, grease as people were working on them, because if that got into the cord of the tire, it would kind of result in a problem later on. So they made a huge number of those. The reason why they focused then on industrial gloves and that kind of thing was because some of the machines that you need to make really, really nice gloves were the ones that we couldn't kind of recover after the fire. So they were 20 years more doing that, and then they were making gloves for the army and the guards. And then around the mid-90s, that kind of all faded away as...
It went offshore.
I think that's the polite way of saying it, yeah.
I didn't know this, that our defense forces are not using your gloves because your brown gloves with the snaps. I mean, when I look at an officer in our defense forces, that's what he or she is wearing. Is that right? Or
yeah, well, they're wearing a version of that. Yeah. So we
it's a lovely glove.
Yeah, it is. It's really nice, and it's a traditional kind of traditional style, and it's one that's very popular.
And the guards, when they're whacking you, they're now not wearing the big black gloves.
Be lucky to wear gloves at all.
Well, maybe those days have moved on as well. So what is the business now? I mean, gloves went out of, well, not so much, gloves never go out of fashion if you're cold, but are you still making the ascot gloves, the ones for the, when you're going to the races that you...
Yeah, we make very posh gloves. yeah. So there's a whole kind of a panoply. I don't know what the right word is. A whole kind of swathe of kind of gloves that we make. And we try. I guess when you're making things, part of you wants to focus on the kind of the really high end stuff. But yeah, you know, you're employing people, and you have to kind of get paid for the other 40 weeks of the year that it isn't cold.
But some of them, some of your gloves are, I mean, they're not cheap. These are beautiful items. Yeah. Did I see one pair at 550 quid or something like that?
Yeah, so we make a pair from a leather called peccary, which is a wild South American hog. And
it's a bit lumpy.
It is. The leather itself is very expensive to begin with. When it comes in, it's in dreadful order.
We
import it.
Where would a man go to find lumpy pigskin?
Peru.
Yeah. And do you go down to Peru too?
No. No, there are leather shows. There's a leather show in Paris every year, and there's one in Milan.
Okay.
And as a hardship, I go to the one in Milan sometimes. I don't think anybody in the family believes that's the reason. But anyway, we're very lucky to meet a company there that sell them, and they've a kind of a nice quality of that. They'd be one of the few places left that actually kind of, you know, manufacture and tan that leather. So it's an expensive leather to begin with. When it comes in, it's usually in kind of fairly bad nick. So my father is the only one who's allowed to cut it because he's the top man. He's the expert in that regard. Yes, there's a lot of waste, and it's an expensive thing, and then it gets hand sewn, and it's not an easy, you know, it could take 2 days to make a pair of those.
And where would a man sell one of those pairs of gloves? I know you've got a beautiful website, but
yeah,
is there a demand? Say, are you still in Harrods or any of these fancy shops?
No, we're not. No. We sell those from our website, and we do sell a fair few of them from our website. I think in the past, most of those when we sold them would have gone to New York. It's a status symbol. It's something that people who have a few bob want to show.
You're dead right. I can see it in my mind's eye now. If you imagine people of, I have to be careful now what I say. Anyway, hoodlums. they wore those things, didn't they?
It was mostly kind of New York Stock Exchange people.
Hoodlums. So, yeah.
that's the right way of putting it.
Exactly the ones that you're talking about. And yeah. You'd have to wear, is it a Stomberg hat, or what's that called? One of those ones. Yeah. So they're buying off your website, but you also told me just before we came in here that you actually have footfall into your factory nowadays.
Yeah.
Americans are coming in.
Yeah.
So where are they finding you?
I have no idea. No. we recently moved over to Smithfield, kind of Stony Water direction with all the hipsters, which is all very nice. And since then we've, you know, it's kind of a tourist trail sort of area. And we have people drifting in to us, which is part of our long-term plan is to, I'm not sure how to put this into the right words, but I'll try and explain what I do. A lot of places that are traditional kind of industries, I mean, it's hard to make a living out of what you're doing. So if you can incorporate some kind of tourist element to that.
Distilleries do.
Yeah, exactly. My dad keeps saying he's fascinated by how people love to come in and watch other people work.
Well, you know that standard one. I love work. I could watch it all day.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is it. But people are fascinated by it because they see, you know, they come in, they see people using sewing machines or sewing by hand or Brian cutting by hand or me using another machine. And it is interesting. It's an interesting thing to see. And we're very happy to have people come in and look at it. So I guess for us, the model in the future is that it'll be some version of a museum meets a business, but it'll be something that kind of holds on to the kind of traditional way of doing things, shows people how it's done, and then gives you the opportunity maybe to but there, buy some of our
I presume
product.
That you have seen a resurgence in people wanting to have beautiful items like this. It's I know that you sell them because, again, on the website, it's very big, is the as a gift. Oh, it must be a gorgeous gift, a forever gift.
Yeah, no, it is. And I guess the thing about, I mean, obviously we're going to say this, but the thing about the clothes that we make is that, you know, they're made to last and they're made to have be something that you would have forever. We've had, I know we're at 2024 now, but in the last year, we've repaired maybe 6 pairs of gloves of people who had gloves for 40, 50, 60 years that were George Horn gloves.
Them.
And we, yeah, now you have to kind of speak nicely to us and kind of blackguard us into us and that kind of thing. Well, we say no lots of times, but we probably will in the end. But if they're our own gloves, yeah, we'll do that. And sometimes it's the linings have gone in them because the linings will go over time. Or there was a man whose father's gloves, he had inherited gloves from his father and they had, the dog had got at them and really done a job on them. But we got them back together again. And
you are... I thought that you were only 2, but you tell me that you're now 5 and trying to grow. But one of the issues that you have is where do you find a glove maker?
Yeah, I think, and I suppose the way our economy has gone, 60 years ago, there would have been a lot of people with the skills to do sewing, a lot of women in the economy with the skills to do sewing and that kind of stuff. Whereas now that's not as easily kind of come by. So,
Annalise Duffy is bringing back linen making, and she's been on the show twice, if not 3 times, and she will find you people with the right skills.
Yeah, so it's about that. I mean, as I mentioned to you beforehand, in the last year we've had 2 ladies from Ukraine come into the business. They were seamstresses already, and it's a matter of kind of getting them used to the sewing machines that we use and the it's a slightly different way of sewing, but it's good and it works. So trying to rebuild that capacity is not that easy. And I guess, you know, it'll still take us longer to make a pair of gloves than it would have 40, 50 years ago. But that's, I suppose, we're a small business now as well compared to what we were. So it's...
But when you say it would take you longer, is that just because the machines that you don't have or...?
Yeah, well, I guess if you're making... We're not at a scale yet that we can kind of benefit from. Maybe if you're making 1 pair of red gloves and 1 pair of black gloves, then you're changing a lot of things to kind of go from red to black. If you're making 12 pairs, you make them and then you change and so you're...
And you use the word yet, that you're not of a scale yet. Is growth big on the agenda?
Yeah, it is, I think. I think that we've an ability with the team we have now to grow quite a bit. And I think there is a demand out there, not for large scale. I mean, we're never going to make 10,000 pairs of communion gloves again.
That, I think those days are gone anyway, aren't they?
They are gone.
I'd say little girls probably still would love them, but
yeah, I think they would. And well, I mean, look, I suppose in the even longer term, I know my dad always maintains that the motor car was really what killed the glove industry. In that, you know, when he was younger, people were outside a lot, so you had to kind of put a nice pair of gloves on, and you were wearing them because you were out in the cold for 5 or 6 months of the year. So as we move back towards more public transport and this kind of thing.
You remind your dad of the thing called a driving glove. Do you remember the driving glove?
Yes, yeah. We make them.
do you?
We do.
I'm still trying to find out. I'm a car nut, but I'm still trying to figure out why does anybody need driving gloves? But anyway.
I have no idea. Or what particularly about those gloves makes them driving gloves.
They have to be cut out in the top, isn't that right?
Yeah.
You have to look like Steve McQueen is one of those lads.
Well, I think that's it. If you have a cigar and you know, the nice car. Although now with some of those luxury cars, what they want is they want it to be touchscreen
friendly. That's things I wouldn't have thought of. Okay.
Yeah. We haven't quite cracked that nut yet.
And another thing up on your website that you are looking for is that you're looking for your top end designers to collaborate with you.
Yeah,
is that
we're very happy to collaborate with anybody. So over the years, we would have collaborated with a lot of people.
Name names. Anybody interesting that you know that you're working with at the moment or anything like that?
No, well, we're working. There's a young woman from NCAD who we've been working with for the last year, Siobhan Curtis. She's just about to kind of go out on her own, and you know, she's finished her degree and that kind of stuff, and she's been working with us to get some experience in the leather industry and to do some designs. So we have some of her designs which we will have at showcase next week. When
fabulous.
Yeah, when we're going.
Well, that's
out.
Really, really cool.
So that's why I was really happy to come over here today, because they were busy figuring out how they were going to do it. And that just wouldn't work for me. So.
And look at your journey is so As I say, PhD. So what's your plan now for the business longer term?
Okay. I think longer term, as I said to you, there's three aspects that we want to develop. First of all, is we want to kind of really push hard into America if we can. I think there's opportunities maybe in smaller retailers and stuff like that that we can facilitate. That would be good. Second aspect is to, as I mentioned to you, and it is to kind of develop a more, I suppose, a cultural aspect or a tourist aspect or whatever it is to our business, where, you know, the people can come in, they can see what's happening, they can enjoy that aspect of it. Sell them coffee and this kind of stuff if we have to, but there's more money and gloves at the same time. And the third thing that I know my father's very keen on, and I am as well, is to start to use the technology that has developed around 3D printing and around scanning and that kind of stuff to be able to model people's hands and then produce kind of really genuinely bespoke gloves to match that from anywhere. Particularly people who have difficulties with their hands, or they've lost a finger or something like that.
That's a lovely idea.
So to be able to kind of cater to that, or, you know, I think would be really, that's the plan. Because it's not something that is going to be mass produced regardless.
And do tell the story, because this has to get out, is the Americans who go in, there's no haggling when they buy your gloves. Yeah. Irish people...
haggle.
buy haggle. They want to take a tuppence off your threepence or whatever.
That's it.
Come on, guys. This is a company well worth encouraging. And it's brilliant. I love that whole backstory. Yeah. Now, you do know that we do ask a final question, which is, who would you, Ger Horn, hire in a heartbeat?
Okay, I'm going to be really cheeky. Can I say that I know, you know, my dad always talks about a lady who used to work for him called Marie Kavanagh, who used to be one of the Peaky Machinists, and that's the type of sewing that we do. And
it's a very hard bit of sewing, isn't it?
It's as hard as you can get. It's done up in midair. There's no way of disguising any mistake that you make. And once you make a mistake, the whole glove is ruined. So it's a serious piece. And she could do, I don't know, she could make a lot of gloves every week, and that would be my ideal. But I suppose more realistically, less realistically, really. I don't know. I'm not kind of a traditional business person, as you've said, so I don't follow the kind of the business gurus or anything like this. Well, I'm fascinated by when I hear people like Stuart Lancaster talk about teams and about the importance of kind of team building and the importance of kind of reacting to things that are around them. And I know he has this idea of playing rugby or sport in chaos, and I'm interested in the idea of business in chaos. And look, every day you go in, if you're working for yourself, something different is going to happen. Something that you didn't want to happen is going to happen. 10 things that you didn't want to happen are going to happen, and some good things are going to happen as well. And you know, I'm interested in an approach of how you can kind of maximize your return living with that, and living with the world not being perfect, and you trying to kind of focus on that and build a kind of a solid team that can be resilient within that.
So does that mean that you actually want Stuart to go and work with you?
Absolutely.
Because the other one that you should be mentioning is, if anybody knows seamstresses or people who can sew properly and sew and I do understand from Annalise Duffy, you are looking for industrial machinists, who runs off a dress or something like that.
No. So industrial machinists, particularly people with experience making gloves, I would have them in a heartbeat. So
there you go, in a heartbeat. You'd hire them in a heartbeat. Maybe that somebody who has come in from other people from Ukraine may have these skills.
Absolutely, there'd be people from there. One thing, and I think it's been part of why in the last few years people have picked up the business. Brian is 78 and he works every day. He enjoys it. I'm not saying everybody who's 78 will enjoy it, but there are other older people who have the sort of skills that we need. It's a taxing job mentally sometimes, but it's not a taxing job physically. So, you know, if people are there who have those skills and experience and they want to
contact you, they will find you on your lovely website, which is
georgehorn.ie.
George Horn, without no E's or anything else.
No E's or A's or anything like that.
Just pure old George Horn.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. What a story. I love it. Ger, thanks so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
That Great Business Show.
De Facto, the revolutionary shaving oil, changing the face of shaving. For the smoothest shave of your life, just add water. No more lathering up or cleaning up afterward. Just add a few drops of water and you're ready to go. De Facto's blend of all natural oils hydrates and protects your skin, No more razor burns or irritation. A spa treatment for your face. Perfect for all skin types and lasts so much longer than traditional foams or gels. DeFacto, a shaving revolution. Just add water. Available from selected pharmacies and from defactoshave.com.
That Great Business Show. Winner, highly commended award. Irish Podcast Awards.
Recruitment company Mason Alexander is growing very fast. They have offices in Ireland, Portugal, Romania, and the US. Curiously, not in the UK, something we'll have a look at. And it's where company founder Andrew Lynch is based here in the US. He has another company also called Enable. Andrew joins me as part of our Beachhead USA mini-series explaining why doing business in the US is different. Andrew Lynch, welcome to That Great Business Show. But before I start, one question that you weren't expecting. You could have been huge in ponchos, but you didn't. You changed from ponchos to recruitment. Why?
So I just go back a little bit. When I left school at 18, I decided not to go to university and always wanted to be an entrepreneur.
So enterprise in the family?
Yeah, my dad was an entrepreneur and I don't know, I just like the cut and thrust of it. And it took me a few years to figure that out. You know, I think it's hot when you're 18. It's, you're very, you're unsure. I didn't excel at all in class and school. And I was just an really ordinary kid and like I still am. But, I think to take the leap of faith into doing your own thing, it takes you have to believe. And it took me a few years to get that. But I started dabbling in a few different things. And ponchos is one of them. And
get ponchos. I think what's ponchos.
Yeah, it's actually
plastic bags on.
Yeah, it was a very short-lived business. Unfortunately, they came in from China at 1 cent a pop or something, and my plan was to sell them for five euro a poncho. And I think it was like the warmest summer we'd ever had. Warmest winter we'd ever. It just never rained at all, and. I think the final nail in the coffin was I went down to the RDS, it was the horse show or something, and it was lashing rain. And I went down, backpack full of ponchos. I was like, here's how I'm going to make all my money. And I went along, I think I sold two, and I went to the third person and they said, what are you doing selling these for a fiver? Like, Potato FM and everyone at Four hand these out for free. So I went around the corner and they're all there giving out for free and just completely... undercut my business model. So that
lesson was in business.
Lesson in business. So and a few other things. I did like a secondhand women's clothing wholesale and loads of other bits and pieces that never took off. And then got into the.
But it didn't stop you.
Yeah, I think you need that. I think in business you need to keep getting back up from the setbacks. And
but ponchos, secondhand clothes, and now you've got not one but two businesses.
Yeah.
How did you choose recruitment?
I love the cut and thrust of sales, and I what I didn't want to do was sell a product. It didn't really excite me, and I was thinking about how can I do something that's I'm selling more on people and understanding people and more of a concept versus a product. Hey, here's a phone. It's $100. There you go. And someone said to me, you thought of being a sports agent. I thought I'd like that. Looked into it. So I have a few buddies in that play professional sports. And it wasn't for me. And then so somehow led me to recruitment.
But sorry, you skipped over that. And I'm interested because some people, not all, but some people have made a very good career as being sports agents. What was it that you didn't want to do or didn't appeal to?
I don't know. I think it's a small market in Ireland. There's a couple of people that do it. A good friend of mine, Dave McHugh, pretty sewn up. And I don't know. It was a thought. But from that thought, it led me into, well, actually, instead of dealing with sports people, you can deal with, accountants or bankers or software engineers. Lucky me. And so I joined a company for about 15 months just to figure it out. It was probably a good start, actually, a good lesson in it that it was right in the middle, it was 2010, right in the middle of the financial crisis. And I was like, oh, great, this recruitment thing. I knew nothing about it, looked it up. And I was like, well, that sounds quite interesting. I think that could be something I'm good at.
Tell me that you YouTubed it.
No, I didn't YouTube it. I think something came about like a day in the life of, and it sounded way more glamorous than it actually is. But I foolishly then started emailing these companies saying, hey, like, I'm keen to join you. And I think I got a couple emails back kind of And do you have any idea what's going on in the world? Like, no one's hiring and we're not hiring. But then I was like, no, I need to find out more about this. So there's one company I kept emailing the guy and ringing him, and eventually I'd ring up, not available, ring up, not available. And eventually he answered, he's like, Jesus, you are like relentless. And I was like, yeah, I need to meet you, because I wanted to know more about it. And actually we ended up getting on quite well. And from there, I met a couple of other companies. So did it for about 15 months. And then, yeah, I went and sold my own thing. I was 26 and just turned 26 and said, yeah, why not?
That seems to be, there's a little bit of a theme picking up with some of the recent podcast interviews that we have done, is that people at about 26 nowadays are thinking about getting out on their own. Makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. I think I tried it a bit earlier. It's challenging. I had an instance where I was doing my own thing for a couple of years. I actually went for a job maybe when I was about 23, 24, and I was in the interview. I was only in about 5 minutes. And as I said, I hadn't gone to college, and we're about 5 minutes into the interview, and the guy was looking through my CV. He goes, oh, you don't have your university on here. And I was like, I didn't go to university. He's like, oh, the interview's over.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And I said, yeah. And
you don't have to name the company, but
I can't remember.
But was it did you want to join an accountancy firm or?
No, it wasn't. It was like I was doing sales or something to that.
I keep telling people this because recently we had a lady on called Laura Lee. She's very big in Molson Coors, the third largest brewer in the world. They no longer want your CV.
Yeah. Now this is going back obviously a few years, and I remember the guy turned to me and said, look, I was like, yeah, it's no problem, walking out the door. And he was like, just so you know, like, this will like haunt you for the rest of your life. This will affect you in your career. And I just walked out the door thinking, what a weird thing to say to someone. And I wasn't annoyed or like, oh, I'm going to show him. I didn't think anything like that. I was just like, yeah, that's, and that gave me another kick to say, you know, if you want anything, you've got to just go and, you know,
do
yourself. So but yeah, 26, I think you're probably at a, you know, you know a bit more about the world, and you've.
No, but it's also bizarre that somebody wouldn't even chat to you.
Yeah. Over. But and again, that was one of the things, you know, for me, I will talk a bit about the US in a minute, but I just think there's, you know, I've seen and I've met so many people that, you know, this kind of whole management layer and how they deal with people isn't good. And I always felt like, you know, that's something I could be good at. I could be good at like understanding what people's strengths are and looking beyond a piece of paper, looking beyond a stereotype, and then trying to inspire them and lead them and allow them to be creative. And I think I'm an okay leader. I'm a terrible manager. I can't manage anyone. But, you know, I think that kind of thing was something that was really driving me to start my own business.
And then to the States. And you have been here 2 years.
Yeah.
And what was the culture shock when you came over?
What was the culture? First thing is just how, you know, how big it is, how you're just a nobody, really a nobody. And
is that a hindrance or is that useful?
It can be both. It can be both. You can, you can be, try and be as dialed in as you want, but you can also walk down the road and no one's going to know you. And that still happens. Like even 2 years on, I know a few more people now, but you can be as visible as you want. And, you know, that's a nice thing. If I'm going to go home, you know, you're not walking down Bagot Street too long before you meet someone, which is also nice. It just, you know, it depends. But I think the size of it, just the sheer the pace of things here is intense.
Which a lot of people have been mentioning, the New York Minute. Mm. Discuss.
It's just everything happens very quickly. Everyone's in a rush. I don't know. There's just so many people, you know, long working days.
How long?
I work long hours, but because I'm, you know, balancing things back in Ireland as well, in Europe. You know, I'm probably starting my day at 5 a.m. most days. And then it just depends. I try and normally finish around 6, 7. But it's like, you know, this time of year, there's a lot of things on in the evening. So then, you know, you could be working later. You know, you could be out doing things. So, but like long days. But just, I don't know, it's everything. Just the intensity, the speed, the abrasiveness.
Talk to me about that because we're always fascinated by that one.
Yeah.
Because it's actually abrasive, but not necessarily rude.
No. I think New Yorkers are great. I think abrasive in the sense that, you know, they just say it as it is. And Yeah, and they'll say it as it is. And you've got to, in terms of your business, and you're out there and you're trying to sell, people tell you that it's crap or they don't like it, but they'll tell you why, and so you learn from it. So this is all these sorts of things. It's just a lot. It's being here is a. Jordan is, like I said, I work long hours, and perhaps I don't, the side effect of that is, I don't sleep a huge amount or as much as I should. But like, you wake up in the morning, you get into the city, and it's just the energy, and it's an adrenaline, it's a drug, and I love it. And it does give you, I think New York can quickly, listen, don't get me wrong, you have days where you're questioning everything and self-doubt, and the city will beat you up and push you down when you're feeling like that. But it also gives you a lot from the sense of like encouragement and motivation and just excitement. And yeah.
And you have chosen probably a cutthroat industry, being recruitment.
Yeah.
And finger in the air, how many recruitment companies in the broadest sense are there in the city? 1,000, 10,000, 100,000?
Well, I don't know.
How many
thousands? Thousands. Thousands and thousands.
And how do you make a living? How do you cut through?
Look, no matter what your business here is, I met a guy last year. He reached out to me, and he's an Irish guy. He's been here about 30 years, a banker. And he reached out to me and said, hey, if you want to get a coffee, I'm happy to. Really nice of him. So I met him for a coffee and gave me a bit of advice. And I think this is across any business. I have a second company as well, Enable Digital Services. But no matter what you do. But he said to me, he's like, Andrew, piece of advice, how to make it in New York. And I was like, oh, great. Yeah, tell me. I can't wait to hear this. And he said, it doesn't matter if you've got the best company in the world or the worst company in the world. All that matters in New York is that you have relationships. People know you, they like you, they trust you. And that's what it is. And being here, it is a great place to meet people. So as long as you're prepared to get out there, put yourself out there, go to events, go to meetings, go to like all sorts of things that go on in the city, and just generally get out there, reach out to people, meet people. And you've got to, I suppose, coming from, if I was at something in Dublin, you'd go into a room and probably know a bunch of people. You come in here, you don't know anyone. And that's no matter how many times you've done it, it's still a bit intimidating and you're still outside of your comfort zone. But it's that sort of, I love that. I always see it as a challenge and something to overcome. And
so you have networked obviously very well, because you are building this company rather quickly and rather big relative. And you must be doing something beyond just networking.
Yeah. Well, look, I wouldn't say I've built it big yet, but that's the plan.
It's okay. It's healthy. Yeah. What I've seen.
Yeah. It's always the... just never satisfied, always pushing for more. And we've come here because we believe that there's a massive opportunity, and that's what we're going after.
But if there is that massive opportunity, as I said, there must be 10,000 recruitment companies here. How can you get to the top here? We're always looking for the differentiator.
Yeah, it's focus. It's being really, really specific about what you're doing and what you're going after. And biggest challenge actually coming here is, because there's so much opportunity, you want to go after everything. And that's actually the biggest mistake you can make. And people reach out to me all the time that come into town, and generally if I can meet them, I will. And that's one of the things I will always say. I'm not giving them advice. I'm just saying, from my experience, we came in saying we do everything, and it's wrong. You've got to get really narrow, really niche, and you build it from there, and figure out who's your target market, who you're going after. And getting into the real granular companies, people, and it's from that. And that's one of our key strategies.
From a standing start, how long did it take you, one, maybe for that penny to drop, two, to actually get traction in that, in being that focused?
Well, it took us a while to get focused, to be honest. So that was the biggest thing. But I think in the last, over the last 12, 15 months, we've become much better at that. As I said, on the Enable the Digital Services business, we've become very, very narrow into...
Well, let's talk about that, exactly what you're doing with that.
Yeah, so it's a digital services company. So we build and manage data engineering teams, software engineering teams for companies. So
that mean, say, a case study for somebody listening who says, data, a lot of talk about data, but I don't really understand what he's saying.
Yeah, so good example. In the last 12 months, obviously, there's been a lot of hype about generative AI. And lots of companies now want to look and explore that, and how can generative AI help their companies drive revenue, cut costs, all the good things that can potentially come with it. But to leverage generative AI, AI, or any of these types of tools, you need to have good, clean data, and most companies don't. So what we do is we go into companies, we help them understand where their data sits, where it lies, how they build a roadmap to achieving a source of truth with their data, and we will build and manage the team to go and do that for them. So we roll in and we roll off. And we have some, again, you talk about recruitment companies here, the digital services space is really packed, thousands and thousands and thousands from the Accentures all the way down. And again, very, very competitive. But one, our focus is on data. And the second is the market that we go after, mid-market. And the third is that it's a very agile, flexible solution. So companies can scale it up, scale it down. They can switch us on, switch us off, which is relatively uncommon where most of these types of firms like ours will want, you know, minimum contract lengths, minimum spend. And especially what's happened in the last 18 months in terms of the global economy, yeah, it's companies are very cautious about how they're spending at the moment.
And how do you get known again from a standing start? Such a specific industry. How do you get known in New York, in the US?
Yeah, and again, I'm still figuring that out. But everything and anything, as I said, you've got to be smart about how you're trying to connect to people. So to get to the granular, cold outreach, emailing, LinkedIn messaging, it doesn't work. You're trying to sell something through that, it doesn't work. Everyone's just plagued with spam emails now. So, it's spending time, if there's a group of people or companies that you're going after, knowing more about them, having a tailored approach, being clever about, I've set up a network here of people. And that's so our buyers typically would be CTOs, CIOs. So instead of me trying to sell to them, I say, how can I actually get them to work with us? So doing things like setting up an advisory board to help us, just an advisory board, not a board, to help us to connect in. So they're supporting us with our go-to-market strategy. They're supporting us with, if we get in with companies that, there's obviously incentive for them to do that. So there's that. Again, there's going to events, there's doing things on social media, I post quite regularly on LinkedIn. Again, more or less it's free advertising because you can spend gazillion dollars in America advertising, not even going to marketing, you're not going to scratch the surface. And just think, if you get a chance to speak at something, you speak at it. Just everything and anything, do you know? And just being out there, that's the other thing I get asked is, could you just not come in once a month, once a quarter? You can do anything. There's no set way to do it. But I think just being here, even walking to come and meet you, I had two different people mentioning, hey, you're around for a beer this evening. And it's just, and typically that would be after work, you'll go and you'll probably bump meet five or six people you've never met before. And the city's great for that, and that's how you,
but
it's not great for your liver, but
But in some sense, you've got to do some work. All I'm hearing at the moment is networking and the work you put into it and all the other stuff that you do to get known, but you then have to deliver actual.
Yeah, but that's where the long hours come in. That's where you do long days, and that's not just. I think that's quite typical from in New York. I think it's the same at home, but maybe not to the same extent. I think difference I've noticed is, I know us as a company did a lot, especially around the pandemic, but even before then, definitely before then, around people not working, long hours, sending emails. I used to send emails at the weekend because I used to work at the weekend, and a great HR person for many years who it's like can't do that anymore. Mental health and allowing people to switch off. So I think that at home it's a lot better for that. Here it's not. There's very the kind of rules of engagement are. If you work for someone, you're their property and they can, and so I have friends here who are, Irish, but I have lots of American friends who, they could be getting pinged at 11 o'clock at night and, to go back to it. It's the culture. It's like.
Tell me, I think I mentioned earlier that you didn't go into the UK very briefly. What was the decision or the non-decision not to go into the UK?
Yeah, I don't know. We did look, I think we had a couple of exploratory conversations about it. And I don't know, it just never really seemed to sit with us. The plan was always come to the US. I was here in March 2020. We were planning to set up here in April 2020 or May 2020. And I was at a dinner in Washington on, I think it was the 16th. And at the dinner, Donald Trump announced a travel ban and in, out, no one knew. And so flew home the next day. And that was the, So it just never was. I don't know, it just never was on the radar. And kind of don't have any regrets about that.
Two or three do's or don'ts for people like yourself coming over to set up business here, very briefly.
Well, outside of the things that I've just mentioned, I think do's are, one, do plug into the Irish network here. It's strong. It's strong. Don't over rely on it. It's a big place. Lots of other people you can meet as well. Do take time to have headspace and try and be calm and think clearly. Don't get caught up in the craziness that is here. And that's something I battle with every single day and trying to, you know, get time to, because otherwise you're just making irrational decisions and that's where mistakes obviously come. And do just have a plan, you know, back yourself. You've got to have huge amounts of belief and resilience and
energy from what I'm hearing.
And energy. And I think you've got to iterate. There's a lot, you just hear lots of opinions here. I meet people and I'm very quick to not give out advice because all I can do is share my experience or learnings. You know, don't be too swayed by everything. I think if you've got a plan and you believe in what you're doing, just stick to that and you'll figure it out, you know, and just keep banging away.
The final question we ask all of our guests is, who would Andrew Lynch hire in a heartbeat?
Probably, when I was in fifth year in school, Michael O'Leary came down to speak to us and it made a massive impact on me. Just how he talked, 2003, I think, how he talked about his kind of post-school and he went to the same school as me, his post-school, how he'd gone into Ryanair and how he'd built it. And something that I think I've always leaned into is like, he's just kind of tried to rip up the rule book all the time. And, you know, because everyone says this, that doesn't actually mean that that's the way you have to do it. And just his, I don't know, I found him very inspiring and funny and great storyteller. And yeah, just had a big impact. So I wouldn't be able to afford him, but maybe him.
And final, all these things, I always throw another question into my head. He has built Europe's largest low-cost airline. What's the ambition, very, very briefly, for Mason Alexander?
Do you know what it is? It's a really hard question to answer because the ambition is to grow the business in Ireland, to grow it more in Europe, to come to the US and grow it as well. I have a second company in Able, which we're growing at the same time. And for me, there's not like an end goal. It's about just the journey and the challenge. And like, I believe in the ability of the people that I work with and what they can achieve and what we can do. And it's just about continuing to keep striving to grow the business and keep facing challenges and keep overcoming them. And I was at home at Christmas and my mother was home for a few days with my parents. My mother was like, put your phones away and just relax for a few days. And she was like, you know, what's the end goal here? Like, when is it going to stop? And I was like,
she asked my question.
Yeah. And I said, well, there isn't one, because like the energy and the drive I get from it, it's for me, it's a vocation. It's not a job. It's a way of being, and I couldn't do anything else. So I don't know, but it's just to continue to keep growing and building and keep delivering value. I think we have huge impact on, you know, our customers and the people that we work with, and that gives us the biggest kick of all. So to keep doing that and keep spreading our wings.
Well, hopefully you will come back to us again when you have sprung your wings a little bit further, and also when Enable grows to a zillion trillion company and all. So please keep in touch with Team GBS, and thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thanks very much, Colin.
De Facto, the revolutionary shaving oil, changing the face of shaving. For the smoothest shave of your life, just add water. No more lathering up or cleaning up afterward. Just add a few drops of water and you're ready to go. De Facto's blend of all natural oils hydrates and protects your skin. No more razor burns or irritation. A spa treatment for your face. Perfect for all skin types and lasts so much longer than traditional foams or gels. De Facto, a shaving revolution. Just add water. Available from selected pharmacies and from defactoshave.com.
It's all go, let Chrissy know on thatgreatbusinessshow.com.
That Great Business Show.
And that is it for episode 175 of That Great Business Show. Great business insights and inspiration, All thanks to our lovely sponsor, De Facto Shaving Oil, the world's best shaving oil. And I know, I've tried the others, but De Facto is the only one I use. Remember to sign up for email updates and we will send you your own personal copy of the podcast at thatgreatbusinessshow.com. Share, like, give us 5-star reviews. It really does help. Advertise with us on That Great Business Show to engage with our incredibly gorgeous audience of entrepreneurs, business owners, business wannabes, investors, people just interested in business. We record at the Dublin South Podcast Studios, where today's studio engineer is Alison O'Dwyer. And later on, the dynamic duo of studio manager Peter Rice and post-production engineer Neil Horner ensure we remain the world's best-sounding business podcast. So for me, Conal O'Moran, buíochas to you all agus slán tamall.